He was awakened by the shouts of the boss boys and the jolting of the coach as it was shunted off the main line. He saw the name of the small village where they had stopped painted on a white board on the platform, Vryburg. But it meant nothing to him. Soon the platform and the coaches were invaded by blue-uniformed railway police, and all the recruits were ordered out onto the platform. They lined up, shivering and sleepy under the floodlights, answered to the roll call. Everyone was present. Hendrik nudged his brother, and with his chin pointed at the wheels and bogey below their coach. The hubs and axles were splattered with blood and tiny slivers and particles of raw red flesh and tissue. All the following day the coaches stood in the siding, while the police individually subjected each of the recruits to a hectoring interrogation in the station master's office. By mid-afternoon, it was obvious that they were coming to accept that the overseer's death was accidental, and were losing interest in the investigation. The evidence of the locked doors and barred windows was convincing, and the testimony of the boss boys and every one of the recruits was unanimous and unshakable. In the late afternoon, they were loaded back into the coaches, and they rumbled on into the night, towards the fabulous ridge of white waters. Hendrik woke to the excited chatter of the men around him, and when he shouldered his way to the crowded window, the first thing he saw was a high mountain, so big that it blocked the sky to the north, a strange and wonderful mountain glowing with a pearly yellow light in the early sun, a mountain with a perfectly flat top and symmetrical sloping sides. "What kind of mountain is this?" Hendrik marvelled. "A mountain taken from the belly of the earth," Moses told him. "That is a mine dump, my brother. A mountain built by men from the rocks they dig up from below." Wherever Hendrik looked, there were these flat-topped, shining dumps scattered across the undulating grassland, or standing along the skyline. And near each of them stood tall giraffes of steel, long-necked and skeletal, with giant wheels for heads, that spun endlessly against the pale, high-velt sky. "Headgears," Moses told him. "Below each of those is a hole that reaches down into the guts of the world, into the rock bowels that hold the yellow goldie for which the white men sweat and then lie and cheat, and often kill." As the train ran on, they saw wonder followed by wonder. Taller buildings than they had ever believed possible, roads that ran like rivers of steel with growling vehicles, tall chimneys that filled the sky with black thunderclouds, and multitudes upon multitudes, human beings more numerous than the Springbok migrations of the Kalahari. Black men in silver helmets and knee-high rubber boots, regiments of them, marching towards the tall headgears, or, as the shifts changed, wearily swarming back from the shafts, splashed from head to foot with yellow mud. There were white men on the streets and platforms, white women in gaily coloured dresses, with remote disdainful expressions. Human beings in the windows of the buildings which crieded wall to red brick wall right to the verge of the railway tracks. It was all too much, too huge and diffuse for them to assimilate at one time, and they gaped and exclaimed and pressed to the windows of the coach. "Where are the women?" Hendrik asked suddenly, and Moses smiled. "Which women, brother?" "The black women, the women of our tribe." "There are no women here, not the type of women you know," said Moses. "There are only the Isifebi, and they do it for gold. Everything here is for gold." Once again they were shunted off the main line into a fenced enclosure in which the long white barrack buildings stood in endless rows, and the signboard above the gates read, "Witwatersrand Native Labour Association, Central Rand Induction Centre." From the coaches, they were led to a long shed by a couple of grinning boss boys and instructed to strip to the buff. The lines of naked black men shuffled forward under the paternal eyes of the boss boys, who treated them in a friendly, jocular fashion. "Some of you have brought your livestock with you," they joked. "Goats on your scalp and cattle in your pubic hairs." And dipping the paintbrushes they wielded into buckets of blue butter ointment, they plastered the heads and crotches of the recruits. "Rub it in," they ordered. "We don't want your lice and crabs and itchy crawlies." And the recruits entered into the spirit of the occasion and roared with laughter as they smeared each other with the sticky butter. At the end of the shed, they were each handed a small square of blue mottled carbolic soap. "Your mothers may think you smell like the mimosa in flower, but even the goats shudder when you pass upwind." The boss boys laughed and shoved them under the hot showers. The doctors were waiting for them when they emerged, scrubbed and still naked, and this time the medical examinations were exhaustive. Their chests were sounded, and all their bodily apertures probed and scrutinized. "What happened to your mouth and your head?" one doctor demanded of Hendrik. "No, don't tell me, I don't want to know." He had seen injuries like these before. "Those bloody animals in charge of the trains," he said. "All right, we will send you to the dentist to have those stumps pulled. Too late to stitch the head. You'll have a couple of lovely scars. Apart from that, you are a beauty." He slapped Hendrik's hard, shiny black muscles. "We'll put you down for underground work, and you'll get the underground bonus." They were issued grey overalls and hobnail boots, and then given a gargantuan meal, as much as they could eat. "It is not like I thought it would be," Hendrik spooned stew into his mouth. "Good food, white men who smile, no beatings, not like the train." "Brother, only a fool starves and beats his own oxen," said Moses. "And these white men are not fools." One of the other Avambo men took Moses' empty dish to the kitchen and returned with it refilled. It was no longer necessary for him to give orders for such menial services. His wants were taken care of by the men around him as if by birthright. Already the death of the white overseer, Sheela the striker, had been embroidered and built into legend by many repetitions, reinforcing the stature and authority of Moses Gama and his lieutenant. Men walked softly around them and inclined their heads respectfully when either Moses or Hendrik spoke directly to them. At dawn the next morning, they were roused from their bunks in the barrack rooms, and after a huge breakfast of maize cake and maas, the thick clotted sour milk, they were led to the long iron-roofed classroom. "Men of 40 different tribes come from every corner of the land to Goldie. Men speaking 40 different languages, from Zulu to Tswana, from Herero to Basuto, and only 1 in 1,000 of them understands a word of English or of Afrikaans," Moses explained softly to his brother, as the other men respectfully made room for them on one of the classroom benches. "Now they will teach us the special language of Goldie, the tongue by which all men, whether black or white, and of whatever tribe, speak to each other here." A venerable old Zulu boss boy, his pate covered with a cap of shining silver wool, was their instructor in the lingua franca of the gold mines, Fanakulo. The name was taken from its own vocabulary and meant literally, "like this, like that," the phrase that the recruits would have urged upon them frequently over the weeks ahead. "Do it like this. Work like that. Sebenza Fanakulo." The Zulu instructor on the raised dais was surrounded by all the accoutrements of the miner's trade, set out on display so that he could touch each item with his pointer and the recruits would chant the name of it in unison. Helmets and lanterns, hammers and picks, jumper bars and scrapers, safety rails and rigs, they would know them all intimately before they stood their first shift. But now the old Zulu touched his own chest and said, "Mina," then pointed at his class and said, "Buena." And Moses led them in the chant, "Me, you." "Head," said the instructor, "and arm, and leg." He touched his own body, and his pupils imitated him enthusiastically. They worked at the language all that morning, and then after lunch, they were divided into groups of 20, and the group that included Moses and Henrik was taken to another iron-roofed building similar to the language classroom. It differed only in its furnishings. Long trestle tables ran from wall to wall, and the person that welcomed them was a white man with a peculiar bright ginger-coloured hair and moustache and green eyes. He was dressed in a long white coat, like those the doctors had worn, and like them he was smiling and friendly, waving them to their places at the tables and speaking in English that only Moses and Henrik understood, although they were careful not to make their understanding apparent, and maintained a pantomime of perplexity and ignorance. "All right, you fellows. My name is Dr. Marcus Archer, and I am a psychologist. What we are going to do now is to give you an aptitude test to see just what kind of work you are best suited to." The white man smiled at them and then nodded to the boss boy beside him, who translated. "You do what Bomvu, the red one, tells you. That way we can find out just how stupid you are." The first test was a block-building exercise which Marcus Archer had developed himself to test basic manual dexterity and awareness of mechanical shape. The multicoloured wooden blocks of various shapes had to be fitted into the frame on the table in front of each subject in the manner of an elementary jigsaw puzzle, and the time allotted for completion was 6 minutes. The boss boy explained the procedure and gave a demonstration, and the recruits took their seats at the tables, and Marcus Archer called, "Enza, do it!" and started his stopwatch. Moses completed his puzzle in 1 minute 6 seconds. According to Dr. Archer's meticulous records, to date, 116,816 had sat this particular test. Not one of them had completed it in under 2.5 minutes. He left the dais and went down to Moses' table to check his assembly of the blocks. It was correct. And he nodded and studied Moses' expressionless features thoughtfully. Of course, he had noticed Moses the moment he entered the room. He had never seen such a beautiful man in his life, either black or white, and Dr. Archer's preference was strongly for black skin. That was one of the main reasons he had come out to Africa 5 years before, for Dr. Marcus Archer was a homosexual. He had been in his 3rd year at Magdalen College before he admitted this fact to himself, and the man who had introduced him to the bittersweet delights had, at the same time, stimulated his intellect with the wondrous new doctrines of Karl Marx, and the subsequent refinements to that doctrine by Vladimir Ilyich Lenin. His lover had secretly enrolled him in the British Communist Party, and after he had left Cambridge, introduced him to the comrades of Bloomsbury. However, the young Marcus had never felt entirely at home in intellectual London. He had lacked the spiked tongue, the ready acid wit, and the feline cruelty. And after a short and highly unsatisfactory affair with Lytton Strachey, he had been given Lytton's notorious treatment and ostracized from the group. He had banished himself into the wilderness of Manchester University to take up the new science of industrial psychology. In Manchester, he had begun a long and lyrically happy liaison with a Jamaican trombone player, and allowed his connections with the party to fall into neglect. However, he was to learn that the party never forgets its chosen ones, and at the age of 31, when he had already made some small reputation for himself in his profession, but when his association with his Jamaican lover had ended acrimoniously, and he was dejected and almost suicidal, the party had reached out one of its tentacles and drawn him gently back into the fold. They told him that there was an opening in his field with the South African Chamber of Mines, working with African mine workers. His penchant for black skin was by now an addiction. The infant South African Communist Party was in need of bolstering, and the job was his if he wanted. It was implied that he had free choice in the matter, but the outcome was never in doubt, and within a month he had sailed for Cape Town. In the following 5 years, he had done important pioneering work with the Chamber of Mines, and had received both recognition and deep satisfaction from it. His connections with the party had been carefully concealed, but the covert work he had done in this area was even more important, and his commitment to the ideals of Marxism had grown stronger as he grew older and saw at first hand the inhumanities of class and racial discrimination. The terrible abyss that separated the poor and dispossessed black proletariat from the enormous wealth and privilege of the white bourgeoisie. He had found that in this rich and beautiful land, all the gross ills of the human condition flourished as though in a hothouse, exaggerated until they were almost a caricature of evil. Now Marcus Archer looked at this noble young man, with the face of an Egyptian god and a skin of burnt honey, and he was filled with longing. "You speak English, don't you?" he asked, and Moses nodded. "Yes, I do," he said softly, and Marcus Archer had to turn away and go back to his dais. His passion was impossible to disguise, and his fingers were trembling as he took up a stick of chalk and wrote upon the blackboard, giving himself a respite to get his emotions under control. The tests continued for the rest of the afternoon, the subjects gradually being sorted and channeled into their various grades and levels on the results. At the end, only one remained in the mainstream. Moses Gama had completed the progressively more difficult tests with the same aplomb as he had tackled the first, and Dr. Archer realized that he had discovered a prodigy. At 5 o'clock, the session ended, and thankfully the subjects trooped from the classroom. The last hour had taxed even the brightest among them. Moses alone had remained undaunted, and as he filed past the desk, Dr. Archer said, "Gama." He had taken the name from the register. "There is one more task I would like you to attempt." He led Moses down the veranda to his office at the end. "You can read and write, Gama?"
"Yes, doctor."
"It is a theory of mine that a man's handwriting can be studied to find the key to his personality," Archer explained. "And I would like you to write for me."
They sat side by side at the desk, and Dr. Archer set writing materials in front of Moses, chatting easily.
"This is a standard text I use." On the card he handed Moses was printed the nursery rhyme, "The Cat and the Fiddle." Moses dipped the pen, and Archer leaned closer to watch. His writing was large and fluent, the characters formed with sharp peaks, forward-sloping and definite. All the indications of mental determination and ruthless energy were present. Still studying the handwriting, Archer casually laid his hand upon Moses' thigh, intensely aware of the hard, rubbery muscle beneath the velvety skin. And the nib spluttered as Moses started.
Then his hand steadied, and he went on writing. He finished, laid the pen down carefully, and for the first time looked directly into Marcus Archer's green eyes. Gamma. Marcus Archer's voice shook and his fingers tightened. You are much too intelligent to waste your time shoveling ore. He paused and moved his hand slowly up Moses' leg. Moses stared steadily into his eyes. His expression did not change, but he let his thighs fall slowly open, and Marcus Archer's heart was thumping wildly against his ribs.
I want you to work as my personal assistant, Gamma, he whispered,
and Moses considered the magnitude of this offer. He would have access to the files of every worker in the gold mining industry. He would be protected and privileged, free to pass and enter where other black men were forbidden. The advantages were so numerous that he knew he could not grasp them all in so brief a moment. For the man who made the offer, he felt almost nothing, neither revulsion nor desire. But he would have no compunction in paying the price he demanded. If the white man wished to be treated as a woman, then Moses would readily render him this service.
Yes, Doctor, I would like to work for you, he said.
On the last night in the barrack room of the induction center, Moses called all his chosen lieutenants to him. They clustered around his bunk.
Very soon you will go from here to the Goldie, he said. Not all of you will go together, for there are many mines along the Rand. Some of you will go down into the earth, others will work on the surface in the mills and the reduction plants. We will be separated for a while, but you will not forget that we are brothers. I, your elder brother, will not forget you. I have important work for you. I will seek you out, wherever you are, and you will be ready for me when I summon you.
Hey, hey! They grunted in agreement and obedience. We are your younger brothers. We will listen for your voice.
Moses went on. You must know always that you are under my protection, that all trespasses against you will be revenged. You have seen what happens to those who give offense to our brotherhood.
We have seen it, they murmured. We have seen it, and it is death.
It is death, Moses confirmed.
It is death also for any of the brotherhood who betray us. It is death for all traitors.
Death to all traitors,
they chanted and swayed together, coming once more under the mesmeric spell which Moses' Gamma wove about them.
I have chosen a totem for our brotherhood, Moses went on. I have chosen the buffalo for our totem, for he is black and powerful, and all men fear him. We are the buffaloes.
We are the buffaloes, they chanted. Already they were proud of the distinction. We are the black buffaloes, and all men will learn to fear us.
These are the signs, said Moses, the secret signs by which we will recognize our own.
He made the sign, and then individually clasped their right hands in the fashion of the white man. But the grip was different. A double grip and a turn of the second finger.
Thus you will know your brothers when they come to you.
They greeted each other in the darkened barracks, each of them shaking the hand of all the others in the new way. And it was a form of initiation into the brotherhood.
You will hear from me soon, said Moses. Until I call, you must do as the white man requires of you. You must work hard and learn. You must be ready for the call when it comes.
Moses sent them away to their bunks, and he and Hendrik sat alone, their heads together speaking in whispers.
You have lost the little white stones, Moses told him.
By now, the birds and the small beasts will have pecked the loaves and devoured the millet bread. The stones will be scattered and lost, the dust will cover them, and the grass will grow over them. They are gone, my brother.
Yes, they are gone, Hendrik lamented. After so much blood and striving, after all the hardships we endured, they have been scattered like seeds to the wind.
They were accursed, Moses consoled him. From the moment I saw them, I knew that they would bring only disaster and death. They are white man's toys. What could you have done with the white man's wealth? If you tried to spend it, if you tried to buy white man's things with it, you would instantly have been marked by the white police. They would have come for you immediately, and there would have been a rope or a jail cell for you.
Hendrik was silent, considering the truth of this. What could he have purchased with the stones? Black men could not own their own land. More than 100 head of cattle, and the local chieftain's envy would have been aroused. He already had all the wives, and more, that he wished for, and black men did not drive in motor cars. Black men did not draw attention to themselves in any way, not if they were wise.
No, my brother, Moses told him softly. They were not for you. Thank the spirits of your ancestors that they were wrested from you and scattered back on the earth where they belong.
Hendrik growled softly. Still, it would have been good to have that treasure, to hold it in my hands, even secretly.
There are other treasures even more important than diamonds or white man's gold, my brother, said Moses.
What are these treasures? Hendrik asked.
Follow me, and I will lead you to them.
But tell me what they are, Hendrik insisted.
You will discover them in good time, Moses smiled. But now, my brother, we must talk of first things. The treasures will follow later. Listen to me. Bomvu, the red one, my little doctor who likes to be used as a woman, Bomvu has allocated you to the Goldie called Central Rand Consolidated. It is one of the richest of the Goldie, with many deep shafts. You will go underground, and it is best if you make a name for yourself there. I have prevailed on Bomvu to send 10 of our best men from the Buffaloes to CRC with you. These will be your impi, your chosen warriors. You must start with them, but you will build upon them, gathering around you the quick and strong and the fearless.
What must I do with these men? Asked Hendrik.
Hold them in readiness. You will hear from me soon, very soon.
What of the other buffaloes? Asked Hendrik.
Bomvu has sent them, at my suggestion, in groups of 10 to each of the other Goldie along the Rand. Small groups of our men everywhere. They will grow. And soon we will be a great black herd of buffaloes which even the most savage lion will not dare to challenge.